Thank you very much. What you've seen just in the lecture that you just heard is one of the things that makes physics so exciting. So this idea that we can learn about this idea that we can learn about black holes by studying Bose-Einstein condensates, in this way at least, is something that I just heard about with you. And I've got another idea, and Bob and I are going to be talking about this later on. And maybe some of you will participate in the conversation. But this idea that you could send sound into here, and by having the conditions of the quantum gas change as a function of height so that this sound bends down and reaches some kind of a critical surface, there's another way that I was thinking as Bob was talking about this that you might realize the same sort of thing. Because in a specially prepared atomic gas that is not necessarily Bose condensed, but could be, you can send light in, and the light can have its group velocity change in a way that depends upon the conditions. And you can, in fact, have the group velocity of the light go to zero. And it may be that one could examine the same sort of critical phenomenon by looking at this critical behavior in the group velocity of light. And that experiment may, in fact, be easier to do than the one with the Bose condensate, which I hate to say because I've got Bose condensates in my laboratory. But, you know, I could probably do this other thing, too. So it may be that there's another way that we could realize exactly the same kind of idea that that Bob has suggested, and we'll have to talk about that a little bit later. Well, anyway, I'm going to talk today about a different aspect of Bose-Einstein condensates, namely the use of those condensates to do optics. And before I start, I just want to acknowledge a whole bunch of people who have worked on this thing, and I'm not going to call all of these names out, but just to indicate that, and not all these people are working on the project right now. These are people that have come and gone and gone on to wonderful careers elsewhere. But for me at least, science has always been a team effort, and it's only through the collaboration with all of these people that things have gotten done. Well, anyway, what I'm talking about is doing optics with cold atoms, and in particular with Bose-Einstein condensed atoms. And the point that I want to make is that these Bose-Einstein condensates, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit more detail, when we do optics with them, it's sort of like doing optics with a laser instead of doing optics with ordinary light. So the difference between the light that you see projected on the screen and this laser light that you now see on the screen is sort of like the difference between the kind of atoms we have in a Bose condensate and the kind of atoms you have in an ordinary gas. So let me talk for just a minute about the difference between this laser light and the ordinary light that we see around us all the time. Well, the difference is that laser light is coherent. What does that mean? Well, by comparison with ordinary light, if I look at the light from a light bulb, the light coming out of a light bulb is a jumble of different wavelengths and different points of origin. Whereas laser light, if it's good laser light, is all the same color, that is all the same wavelength, and it appears to come from a point. And the fact that it appears to come from a point means that you can collimate the laser light. I mean, I can shine this laser beam around the room and it doesn't spread out very much. That's really hard to do that with ordinary light. And I can focus it to a small high intensity spot. That's what makes your CDs work, the fact that you can focus a laser beam down to a tiny spot where the information is written in bits onto the CD. So a lot of the things that we use laser light for are related to its coherence properties. That has to do with spatial coherence. There's also temporal coherence, the fact that the laser light is all one color, and that temporal coherence is used for some very practical things. I can make an interferometer. This is a Michelson interferometer. I can make an interferometer using laser light. The light comes in, hits a beam splitter. Some of the light goes this way to a mirror and bounces off. some of the light goes straight through and bounces off another mirror, and the reflected light from these two mirrors is recombined on the beam splitter, and depending upon the phase of the two beams of light that are recombined on the beam splitter, I can get either constructive interference or destructive interference. And depending upon how many quarter wavelengths I move this mirror, I may have this constructive interference or destructive interference. So if I have a detector sitting here and I move this mirror by just one quarter of a wavelength, the detector will go from seeing a lot of light to seeing just a little bit of light, and I can count off the displacement of this mirror in quarter wavelengths simply by looking at the amount of light coming out of here. Well, this is done all the time. In fact, in sophisticated machine shops today, devices like this are attached to the lathes and the milling machines so that a machinist can machine a piece to accuracy that is very difficult to get by ordinary techniques, can be gotten very easily. So the coherence of laser light is now something that is used to machine parts in a machine shop. So coherence is something that has a very practical application. And I'm going to be talking today about coherence not of light, but of atoms. And of course, the reason we talk in this way is because, as we all know, atoms also behave like waves. Now, usually, the wave nature of these atoms is not very apparent because the atoms are moving so fast and they're so massive that the de Broglie wavelength given by this expression is quite short. So, for example, sodium atoms, as you might see in a sodium street lamp, are moving at a velocity of about 1,000 meters per second, and the de Broglie wavelength is a fraction of an angstrom. That means that it's a fraction of the physical size of the atom itself. And under those circumstances, the wave nature is not often very apparent. On the other hand, over the past 20 years or so, we in our laboratory in Gaithersburg and other people around the world have learned how to laser cool atoms to extremely low temperatures, which is to say to extremely low velocities. And for example, if you have these same sodium atoms moving at 1 centimeter per second instead of at 1,000 meters per second, the de Broglie wavelength is 2 micrometers, which is quite a bit longer than the wavelength of visible light. And under those circumstances, you might expect the wave nature to be quite apparent. But until recently being 1995, all of the atom waves that anybody made, whether they were short wavelengths or long wavelengths, were incoherent in the sense of being like the light that comes from this overhead projector, rather than being coherent like the light that comes from this laser. But then in 1995 came Bose-Einstein condensation. So, what is Bose-Einstein condensation? Well, it's a phase transition. We just heard about phase transitions. It's a phase transition in an ideal gas. Now, that in itself is a strange thing, because the kind of phase transition that Bob Laughlin was just talking about in a van der Waals model of phase transition has to do with the interactions between the atoms. But this phase transition is something that occurs in an ideal gas, a gas where there are not any interactions, or at least it can occur in that kind of a gas. It's a phase transition that has to do with the quantum statistical properties of the atoms that make up the gas. And this is how the transition comes about. When you have a gas of bosons and it's hot, then we can treat the bosons pretty much like classical particles. Their de Broglie wavelengths are extremely short, and it's okay to treat them as if they were classical particles. Now, as we make the gas colder, the wavelength becomes longer, and at some point, the wavelength of the atoms becomes comparable to the spacing between the atoms. And at that point, the atoms undergo a kind of quantum identity crisis. They can't distinguish themselves from their neighbors, and their response to this quantum identity crisis is that a large fraction of the atoms in the gas go into the lowest quantum state available. Perhaps the atoms think that they can hide there, but they can't really hide. In any case, the atoms end up with a large fraction of them in the lowest energy state available, and that that transition that occurs where a large fraction of the atoms go into the lowest energy state is called Bose-Einstein condensation. Now, another way of expressing the condition under which the atoms Bose condense is that the phase space density of the gas becomes high, that the number of atoms per unit volume per unit momentum interval becomes on the order of the inverse of Planck's constant cubed. And when that happens, that's when the phase transition occurs. That means that what we need to do is to get the atoms very dense so that the volume density is high, and very cold so that the momentum density is very high. Now, laser cooling and trapping, which is the subject for which Steve Chu and Claude Cohen-Tanugini and I shared the Nobel Prize in 1997, gets you close to that condition, but still several orders of magnitude away. So as cold as we have been able to get things by laser cooling, it's not sufficiently cold to observe Bose-Einstein condensation. So we need another trick, and the trick that's used is really a very old idea. It's called evaporative cooling. You know that when you get wet and the wind blows on you, you feel cold, and the reason is that the water molecules that are leaving the surface of your skin, or the surface of the water that's on your skin, are the water molecules that are the most energetic. And that means what's left behind is colder. We do exactly the same thing with a gas of trapped atoms. So imagine that I've got a gas trapped in some sort of a potential well. We make this potential well using inhomogeneous magnetic fields. And the gas is trapped in there, and the densest part of the gas is going to be at the bottom of the trap, that is at the center of the trap. And toward the outside are the most energetic atoms, and some of them can escape. That means they take away more than the average energy. The rest of the atoms re-equilibrate by collisions, and you produce more of the most energetic atoms. They escape, and you continue to cool the gas in this way. And in this way, you can bring the temperature down much lower than you can with laser cooling. And in fact, you get the density higher, because as the temperature is reduced, the atoms settle into the bottom of the trap, that is, into the center of the trap, and they become more dense. So this is what you want. You want more density, you want lower temperature, and that will get you to Bose-Einstein condensation. So here's a graphical representation of what you see when you get a Bose-Einstein condensate. In the temperature above the critical temperature, it looks like an ordinary gas, higher density at the bottom, lower density at the top. But then, when you reach the critical point, a large fraction of the atoms go into the lowest motional state. That is, they go down here into the ground state of this harmonic oscillator trap. And here is a photograph, a series of photographs, showing the velocity distribution of these atoms as you pass through this phase transition. So I hope you can see this. This is a gas of rubidium atoms showing the velocity distribution of the gas of rubidium atoms at various temperatures. This is a temperature of 400 nanokelvin, and that's too hot to observe the phase transition, 400 nanokelvin, and we see here a velocity distribution that is broad and featureless. When I say broad, I mean relatively broad. Of course, it's narrower than any ordinary gas that that ever existed before, but it's broad and featureless. However, when we reduce the temperature to 200 nanokelvin, a sharp spike appears in the velocity distribution, and when the temperature is reduced to 50 nanokelvin, that spike is about all that's left. And this means that nearly all of the atoms have condensed into the lowest available energy state, and this spike represents the ground state of the trapped atoms. So this was first done in Eric Cornell's laboratory in Boulder in 1995, and since then it's been done in other gases, in other groups all over the world. There's now about 25 groups that have achieved Bose-Einstein condensation. But the point about Bose-Einstein condensation is that you can get most of the atoms into the lowest available quantum state. In a certain sense, you might say this is the ultimate in cold gases, because a large number of atoms are at the lowest energy they can possibly be according to the rules of quantum mechanics. But Bose-Einstein condensates are not just a cold gas. They're a coherent source of de Broglie waves. And here is the analogy between a Bose-Einstein condensate and and laser light. If I have an optical cavity consisting of two mirrors, and light can bounce back and forth between those two mirrors, I can put any color of light into that optical cavity as long as it satisfies the condition that an integral number of half wavelengths fit in the length between these mirrors. In the same way, if I have a magnetic trap, I can put any energy atom into that magnetic trap as long as it satisfies the condition that it goes into one of the energy eigenstates of this harmonic oscillator. And I've drawn what a few of those energy eigenstates look like, what their wave functions look like. On the other hand, if I have laser light, what it means is that I have a single color, a single wavelength that is fitting between the mirrors that are inside the laser. And I can let some of that light out, and it's coherent laser light. When I have a Bose-Einstein condensate, it means that I have all of the atoms in a single quantum state. And so this is the analogy between laser light and a Bose-Einstein condensate, that laser light is the occupation of a single mode of the electromagnetic field in this cavity, and Bose-Einstein condensation is the occupation of a single state of motion of a trap. Now, what are we going to do with these Bose-Einstein condensates? Well, what we're going to do in order to use them in the same way that that coherent light can be used is we're going to do optics with them that is similar to the optics that we do with coherent light. So one of the things that we're going to do is analogous to Bragg reflection. Now, you probably all studied about Bragg reflection in the context of X-rays reflecting off crystal planes. And you know that if the X-rays come in and reflect off these crystal planes, there is some direction that the incident X-rays can come in at, so that, that when they reflect in a specular way off of these planes, that they satisfy the condition of constructive interference. And then you reach the Bragg condition that is indicated by n lambda equals 2d sine theta, where theta is the angle that the X-rays make with the vertical. And you have to satisfy the condition that the reflection is specular and that you get constructive interference from each one of these planes. Well, it turns out we can do something very similar with our Bose condensed atoms, reflecting them not from physical planes of atoms in a crystal, but from the planes formed by the interference of two laser beams of coherent light. And here's one of the ways of thinking about how that happens. Here is my Bose condensate sitting in free space. Now I apply a pulse of laser light, but this pulse is really a standing wave of laser light with laser beams coming from each side, but the frequency of one of the laser beams is slightly different from the other, the frequency of the other laser beam. And what that means is that instead of having a fixed standing wave, I've got a standing wave that's moving. And so, because the standing wave is moving, it's as if I had a set of planes, as in this crystal, and I was moving that set of planes past the atoms. It doesn't matter whether I move the atoms past the planes or whether I move the planes past the atoms, I get the same effect. Now, a perhaps more convenient way of thinking about this is that the atoms in this Bose condensate can absorb a photon from this blue beam, and they can be stimulated to emit a photon into this red beam, so that they pick up the momentum of one of the photons in this blue beam when they absorb, and then they get kicked to the right. And then when they are stimulated to emit into the red beam, they are kicked to the right again. And so the atom, after having interacted with this pair of laser beams, has the kick of two photons going to the right. And so if I do this to my sample of Bose condensed atoms, which are basically atoms at rest, they're in the lowest possible quantum state, then I will find, if I do this, that some of the atoms will have absorbed and emitted these photons, and some of the atoms will be moving to the right, and some of the atoms will not have absorbed these photons, and they will be staying still. Now, in fact, saying that is really a lie. When I say that some of the atoms will have absorbed and emitted the photons and some of them won't, that's really a lie. What happens is that every atom is in a coherent superposition of having absorbed and emitted the photons and not having absorbed and emitted the photons. So I may have a million atoms here, and every single one of those million atoms is in a superposition state of being here and being here. This is kind of like the standard quantum mechanical description of Schrodinger's cat, that I can be in a superposition of being in two places at the same time or two different conditions at the same time. Well, it's not really very much like a Schrodinger cat, but in any case, we do have a quantum mechanical superposition. And so every atom is both here and here at the same time. And the separation between these two can be quite large, on the order of millimeters. And when we look at them, then we, in a sense, make a reduction of the wave function, and we find out where these atoms are. Now, let me say a little bit more about how we actually do the experiments. We start off with a gas of atoms in a magnetic trap. We cool them by evaporation. We form a condensate. Then usually what happens is we turn off the trap. Now we have a cloud of extremely slow atoms just sitting in free space. We apply a pair of laser beams to the cloud. A fraction of the cloud absorbs and emits those photons and starts to move off in this direction. And then we just wait. We wait until this part of the cloud has separated from the other atoms, and then we simply take a picture. And by taking a picture, we have, by seeing where the atoms are in space, we have a picture of what their momentum is, because the faster atoms will have moved further, and we've converted momentum into position simply by waiting and taking a picture. Okay. Now, just so you have an idea of what the apparatus looks like, here's a picture of the working part of the apparatus. Of course, it's backwards. There we go. Okay, you'll notice the Bose advertisement there. So this, just to give you some scale, this mirror mount right here is 5 centimeters across, and inside here are are coils of wire that create magnetic fields, and the Bose condensate is formed inside a little glass cell behind these coils of wire. Now, there's 2 meters of laser cooling apparatus over here, and there's another several meters of laser table over here, but this is where it all happens, right here in this small region. And so, we can use this technique of Bragg reflection as a way of coherently manipulating the atoms. And here's a picture of what happens to this cloud of atoms after we have applied this pulse of laser light of 2 different colors. So here is the cloud of atoms before we've done anything to it. Now, the size here, this is actually the narrow dimension of the cloud, is 50 micrometers. 50 micrometers of coherent wave function. This represents half a de Broglie wavelength for these atoms, because this is like a particle in a box in the lowest possible energy state. And this 50 microns represents half of the de Broglie wavelength. That means the de Broglie wavelength is 1/10 of a millimeter. You can see that with your eye, something as large as 1/10 of a millimeter. So this is a coherent wave function, a de Broglie wavelength, that is big enough to see with your eye. And in fact, we see it with an ordinary CCD camera. After applying the pulse to it, it splits the condensate up into 2 pieces, and one of the pieces moves in this direction, and here we take a picture of it. And before the picture is taken, we can think of every atom as being in a superposition of being here and being here. And depending upon how strong the pulse is or how long the pulse is, I can make some tiny fraction of the atoms go in this direction. I can make all of the atoms go in this direction. And if you're familiar with the language of spin resonance, it's as if I can give the atoms a pi over 2 pulse, converting half of the atoms into a different state, or I can give them a pi pulse, converting all of the atoms into a different state. But that different state is not a different spin state, it's a different momentum state. But it's the same physics. Another way of thinking of it is that I can use this Bragg reflection process as either a mirror. What does a mirror do to light? It changes its momentum. And so I've taken this particular momentum of zero and changed its momentum to this momentum, moving down with 2 photon momenta. That's a velocity, by the way, of 6 centimeters per second. So that's how fast these atoms are going. Or I can use a beam. I can use it as a beam splitter. What happens when you send light through a beam splitter? Part of the momentum is unchanged, and part of the momentum is changed. So that's what happens here. Part of the momentum is unchanged, it's still zero, and part of the momentum has been changed to 6 centimeters per second. So I can use this process of Bragg scattering as either a mirror or a beam splitter. And the process is completely coherent, and so I can use it to do things that in optics are coherent as well. So here's one experiment that I want to describe for you. I start with a Bose condensate sitting in free space. I hit it with a pulse of laser light so as to Bragg reflect it. A tiny portion of the condensate, I simply adjust the intensity and the pulse length so that a tiny portion of the condensate is given momentum so that it's going to the right. And now, before that tiny portion has separated very far from the condensate, I hit it again with an identical pulse. So now I have two pieces of condensate heading to the right and overlapping with each other. Now, they represent two components of a wave function. I have to add their wave functions coherently. And so these two pieces of wave function, represented by the green circle and the red circle, they can interfere either constructively or destructively. And, of course, whether they interfere constructively or destructively will depend upon their quantum mechanical phase. And the quantum mechanical phase is constantly evolving in time, so I can choose the phase of the wave function by choosing the time between the first pulse and the second pulse, because after the first pulse, the quantum mechanical phase of this wave function evolves at a certain rate. The rate that it evolves at is 100 kilohertz. It's an extremely slow frequency. That's the rate of evolution of the quantum mechanical phase of this wave function. And then, after a certain time, some microseconds, I can start another wave function going out to the right, and its quantum mechanical phase, compared to the quantum mechanical phase of the first wave function, will determine the interference. So this is what happens. I look at how many atoms are out here, because that's going to determine whether the interference was constructive or destructive. And I do that as a function of how long I wait between the first pulse and the second pulse, because that determines the phase. So this is just like doing an interferometer where I can change the phase of the interference. And this is what happens. When the time delay is very short, I get lots of atoms. When the time delay is 5 microseconds, which is just enough to change the phase by 180 degrees, pi, then the two groups of atoms cancel each other out, and I hardly see anything. But if I wait 10 microseconds, then the interference is constructive again. And then if I wait 15 microseconds, I get nothing, because the interference is destructive. So imagine what is happening. I've got a bunch of atoms. I hit it with a laser pulse. That gives some of the atoms some momentum, so they start moving away. Then I give the same group of atoms an identical laser pulse. That has another group of atoms that starts moving away. And that second group of atoms cancels out the first group of atoms. Now, of course, it sounds silly when you say it that way, but what's really happening is that I'm creating wave function that has a certain phase, and the second part of the wave function cancels out the first part of the wave function. Now, we're used to having this happen with light all the time, but when you do it with atoms, somehow it makes quantum mechanics seem very real. So these atoms just cancel each other out, or they add up to make twice as many atoms as there would be. Well, my time is almost up, so let me just tell you one more thing. We can make a different kind of interferometer, something very much like a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, where I have a beam splitter that splits the light up and recombines it. And I do that with atoms using the Bragg process in exactly the same way that I've described. I split the atoms up, I hit them again with a laser pulse, bring them back together, and I can make them interfere. Now, I can take that same arrangement and I can write onto one of the arms of the interferometer a pattern in light that changes the quantum mechanical phase of the atoms in a certain region of space. Now, this is a macroscopic wave function big enough to see, and I can write letters onto the quantum mechanical wave function in phase, and when it interferes, that phase becomes evident, and we can write our name into the atoms in quantum mechanical phase of wave function. So this represents a kind of manipulation of quantum mechanical wave functions that has never been possible before. Well, there's a whole lot of things that I'd love to tell you about and don't have time to, but we're having a tremendous amount of fun manipulating these wave functions that are now big enough to see, things that bring quantum mechanics into the tangible realm of things that are big enough to see and nearly big enough to touch. And we're really excited about where all this is going to lead. Thank you very much.